Hello, everybody, and welcome. A warm welcome to this evening's public discussion on the subject of literature and terrorism, organised by the University of Manchester's Centre for New Writing. My name is Ian Maguire, and I'm one of the co-directors of the Centre. The Centre, as many of you already know, is home to the University's programmes in creative writing and also contemporary literature. And one of the other things that we do is organise throughout the year a series of readings and public discussions on the subjects of literature and culture, of which this is an example. Before we begin, I'd just like to point out, I think on your chair you have a flyer with information about our upcoming events. It's got two sides to it. So a week today, Jeff Dyer is coming to talk, and if you flip over, you'll see our events for after Christmas. So please do have a read of that, and you're very, very welcome to come and attend any of those events that are upcoming. So the format of this evening is going to be quite simple. I will introduce our three panel members in just a moment. Then each of them in turn will say a few words, speak for a few minutes about the subject in general, sort of laying out their stall and pointing out anything which they think is particularly important and interesting about this topic. Then we'll have a general discussion for about half an hour, 40 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the audience for the last portion of the evening. Before I start, I'd just like to thank Joe Nightingale, who has helped us organise this evening, and without her help, we would be in a big mess. So thanks very much to Joe, wherever she is. Okay, so let me introduce our three distinguished panel members. Directly next to me is Ed Hussain, and Ed is author of The Islamist, a book published earlier this year to much acclaim, published by Penguin. If you haven't read it, The Islamist is Ed's fascinating account of his five-year involvement in Islamic fundamentalism and his ultimate rejection of it. Ed has written widely in magazines and newspapers, including The Times, The Guardian, The Observer, and The New Statesman. He has spoken and been interviewed on numerous occasions on the subject of Islam and Islamism. He's lived and worked and travelled in the Middle East and is currently studying for a PhD when he finds the time at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Next to Ed is Martin Amis. Martin, as well as being the University of Manchester's first Professor of Creative Writing, is also, of course, one of Britain's most important living novelists. Over the last 35 years, Martin has written 11 novels, from the Rachel Papers in 1973 to the House of Meetings last year, 2006, as well as six books of nonfiction and innumerable essays and reviews. He's helped to shape the contemporary British novel, and also by his boldness in speaking on issues of the day, I think more than anyone else perhaps, he's done a lot to argue for the continuing importance of the novel as a form and for the idea of the novelist as someone whose opinions are worth listening to. And next to Martin is Maureen Freely. Maureen is a novelist, a journalist, an academic, and a translator. Maureen was born in America but grew up in Turkey before attending Harvard University. She's written, for amongst other publications, The Guardian, The Observer, The Daily Telegraph, and The Independent on Sunday. She's the author of six novels, including most recently Enlightenment, a novel set in Istanbul and published by Marion Boyars in 2007. Maureen is also notably the English translator of Orhan Pamuk, the Nobel Prize-winning Turkish novelist. She currently teaches creative writing at the University of Warwick. If you could just join me in welcoming our panel. Okay, so we'll start off with these opening statements, and Ed is going to kick us off. So over to you, Ed.
Thank you very much, Ian, and thank you very much, everybody else, for coming. The first point I want to make is a point of distinction between Islam a religion, a faith, my religion, my faith, and the faith of 1.5 billion people across the world. And Islamism, a political ideology initiated in the 1940s that has spread successfully to some extent throughout much of the Arab world and the wider Muslim world, and to our regret, I think, to large parts of the West. So those are the two distinctions between a faith, a spiritual tradition, going back 1400 years, and Islamism, a political ideology influenced, I hasten to add, by Marxism, Leninism, and so on. It's what it is, an ideology, and it compares itself with socialism and capitalism rather than with other faiths. Now, that said, the topic for tonight, the literature and terrorism, my contention is that there is a link between literature and terrorism, especially in the context of Islamism or jihadism-inspired or al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism, whatever it is you want to use. There's a whole debate surrounding vocabulary, but I think most of us know the phenomenon to which we refer. Now, growing up in Britain, my exposure to Islamism, or the political ideology behind terrorism, came about as a result of reading literature in my secondary school. Again, from the literature I was exposed to in my secondary school, I went further. In my local mosque at the time, I was exposed to literature by people, and this goes back many, many years. The first, you know, theological arguments for terrorism in the current world came from a man known as Ibn Taymiyyah, who was a 13th century, quote-unquote, Muslim scholar, who was then quoted in the 1750s by Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab al-Najdi, who was the theological mind behind the creation of the Saudi kingdom today. But in the last century, two names come to mind. One is of Abul A'la Maududi in Pakistan, who wrote, you know, prolifically. And the second is Sayyid Qutb, perhaps better known in the West, for some of his works, including Milestones and others. Now, Maududi was a journalist, Qutb was a literary critic. I'm not suggesting for an instance that everybody who reads Maududi and Qutb ends up as terrorists, far from it. You know, thousands of people have read them and not walked that path. But almost every Al-Qaeda-inspired, jihadism-inspired terrorist of our world today shares that Qutbite, Maududite worldview of creating an Islamist state, not an Islamic state, because that can be argued to be a contradiction in terms, but an Islamist state, which has an expansionist foreign policy, a totalitarian ideology, and so on. They also take inspiration from people like Abdullah Azzam, the great Afghan Mujahid, and he also wrote several books. But the key behind this is that most extremists, terrorists, jihadists, if they're not accustomed to reading themselves, they would have been exposed to those arguments contained in that literature. What does that literature do that inspires people? Well, two things. First, the vast body of that genre talks about the Quran and the Ahadith, or the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, in a very literalist context, without understanding history, scholarship, linguistics, tradition. It's all taken literally. This is what was said, this is what we'll do. Much like fundamentalist Christianity in America, the difference, of course, here is the level of violence. In addition to the literalism, a key theme in most of that genre is that it gives legitimacy to political discourse. So what is essentially political becomes religious because it's bolstered by the writings of those key individuals. So Bin Laden and Zawahiri have, you know, read those materials, and if you listen to their early speeches, they make references to people such as that. Bin Laden, for example, took lessons directly from Muhammad Qutb in Jeddah in the 1980s. Muhammad Qutb was the brother of Sayyid Qutb, who was given refuge by the Saudi government in Saudi Arabia in the 1960s. Now, it's not just that terrorism is inspired in part by that literature. My contention is also that an extremist mindset or a terrorist mindset is also set free by literature. And I speak as someone who underwent that experience of my mind becoming extreme throughout my late teens and much of my 20s. But it was also the fact that I was exposed to literature afterwards, genuine, authentic Muslim literature, most of it in the Sufi tradition, by people such as Jalaluddin Rumi in the 13th century, and his poetry that spoke about you know, a human love and compassion and an understanding of religion that was genuinely universal and humane. Also, Hafiz and Ibn Arabi come to mind. So the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, literature contributes to extremism, but and by extension terrorism, but also literature of the Muslim tradition can also set our minds free from that extremist mindset. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Ed. So now we'll pass along to Martin.
Good evening, and thanks very much for coming. My feeling about what's happened since 2001 is that it's an evolving question. It's something it would be unwise ever to make your mind up about, because it's ramifying and changing, and we're hoping to be getting deeper into the subject, and it's infinitely complex. But one or two moral points, I think, should be made clear. The other night I was doing an event at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, and I asked the audience to put their hands up if they felt morally superior to the Taliban, and about a third of them did. These trembling hands were eventually raised. And then I said, okay, the Taliban, you know, two-day massacres, slaughtering children and animals in the street. When they came to power, almost the first thing they did was ban women from the workplace, at a stroke dismantling their health service and their educational system by this move. And you know, acid in the face of women who's revealing a lock of hair. For a time, they were confining women to their houses and blacking up the windows so that, not only so that they couldn't be seen, but that no light would reach them. And I suppose I should have said, can we have that vote again, after talking for a few minutes about the Taliban. But I don't think the straw poll would have had a different result, because it's a statement of principle that you don't feel morally superior to anyone except America and Israel. How it seems to me the response of the West has gone. You know, the first thing you had to do, this was in the last months of 2001, was do what Ed was talking about and make the separation of Islam and Islamism. And I think we should follow Francis Fukuyama and take it a bit further and say, you know, Islam, Islamism, and jihadism, which is the sort of pointed end of Islamism, but is not always connected with some Islamist parties that are merely traditionalist and reactionary. With that out of the way, what you then have to dispense with, and the West has had a great deal of trouble with this, is what Paul Berman, in his book Terror and Liberalism, has called rationalist naivety. Now, I think everyone here did a bit of that after September the 11th. The first piece I wrote on this subject was published on September the 18th. And I in that piece, as well as registering various sort of levels of shock, I started looking around for, you know, why is this happening? And you still see compassionately frowning newscasters on CNN saying, but why is this happening? You have to get the hang of the idea that it isn't, that much of this is not, as the far left, as the sort of Chomsky left would say, solemnly political tit for tat in response to state terrorism from America. It is not business as usual, this. And I said this to Eric Hobsbawm, who said, no, it's not business as usual. And Eric is not the most pro-American or indeed or pro-Israeli or pro-British historian we have. Also, I think an abject failure to condemn with sufficient vociferousness the disgusting tactic of suicide bombing. This is a new kind of malevolence, in my view. I know it's not historically new, but this And we can tell that it's a new degree of malevolence because of some of the effects that it has, like the extraordinary injustice meted out to Jean-Charles de Menezes, the Brazilian electrician, where the police, clearly in this stage, are absolutely deranged by the possibility that someone is going to turn into an explosion of blood and bone in front of them. Or an even more dramatic example was, I think, in August 2005 in Baghdad, when 1,000 people were trampled to death because people were floating through this procession and saying that there was a suicide bomber among them. Just whisper the word and 1,000 people die. We should be, there should from every corner of this, of the West, be a sort of permanent factory siren of disgust for this action. And to call it martyrdom is an insult. Martyr means witness. A martyr is merely a witness to their own death because they're so unconcerned, they're so far from their persecutors. And that's what it means. And what does the martyr witness? What does he sacrifice? He doesn't even die. He goes straight to paradise. And I would just like to say in closing that it seems to me that September the 11th entrained a kind of moral crash worldwide. And we've been vulnerable to it. And the other side has, you know, as we see in Iraq, a kind of experiment in cruelty going on in there, in a hell we have made, but with a concentration of cruelty that didn't seem on the human, you know, spectrum in the year 2000. It doesn't take long for this to happen, and Britain used all these phrases like extraordinary rendition and enhanced interrogation techniques in response to the IRA, giving you the thought that perhaps terrorism is a kind of gamble on torture, because every terrorist knows that this is the first thing the state will reach for. And when it tortures its suspects, will that radicalize or will it deter? It's a sort of gamble. And it was George Bush who said 2 days, on September the 13th, 2001, said to Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia that if we can't get anything out of them, we'll turn them over to you. The strength of the West is in its morality, in not being morally inferior to the Taliban, and in its trust in reason. And we must guard these two cornerstones of our society. And in the current ongoing crisis, we've had to think very hard about what we value. And surely morality and reason are the princes of our system.
Thanks a lot, Martin.
Martin, you have left a lot for me to say. Can you hear me? Yes? How did 9/11 change the world? Well, in my view, it poured rocket fuel over a group of neocons who were looking for an excuse to go into the Middle East and rewrite it. And most, more to the point, it put Dick Cheney in charge, and Dick Cheney and his gang worked together with al-Qaeda, in my view, to create an east-west divide that hadn't existed before. They have been acting on this fiction, making it come true ever since, and I think we're going to be dealing with the consequences for decades, perhaps centuries. That's just my view. Now, the question is, how can a writer respond to this? The world has changed. This is how it changed. Now, every writer has to find their own way through this, and writing does have a lot to do with morality. And I was going to try to explain the five rules that I try to live up to. And the first rule is to keep myself informed, inform myself. Now, as somebody who grew up on the other side of the East-West divide, I already knew a fair amount about the late Ottoman Empire, and bear in mind that a lot of these areas that we're talking about were part of the Ottoman Empire. I know about the carve-up that happened after World War I. I know about what happened in the 20th century, but I've made it my business to find out more because I think it's everything that is going on now is rooted in those histories. The second thing is, wherever possible, to inform others. Now, having grown up in a secular state that has a mostly Muslim population, I understand Muslim culture in a very, very different and very rooted way, and so I consider it my duty to challenge with facts and as politely as possible the distortions of Islam and Muslim culture that go on all around me. And because I don't present like somebody who would have a link to a Muslim country, believe me, I hear it all the time. I hear it in the senior common rooms. I hear it at dinner parties of people who ought to know better, and they don't. So this is something that goes on and on. But I think it's important to have a conversation, and I think it's important for it to be as courteous as possible. The third rule is that I reserve the right not to write about politics all the time, not to write in a proscribed way, not to force other people to do that either, looking at a political subject, to reserve the right to look at it obliquely, inconveniently, imaginatively. In the areas where I've seen writers become involved in these moral issues and political issues, this is the first thing to go, that very, very basic freedom. To write about what you want to write, and not to write to serve a particular political cause. But there are times because, and there will be more times, when we all have to confront these terrible things that are going on now, and I think they're going to get worse. So, you know, when writing in the face of terror, about terror, when you're terrorized, what to do? And my rule of thumb is to start from where I am, and to start looking at that terror and at the fear and how the effect that it has on people. Now, because of my interesting life, I've been close to many bombs in this country and in Turkey as a child and also in the recent past. And when I've been near bombs and recent bomb sites, I feel a lot of fear, I feel a lot of grief, I feel a lot of anger. But I don't feel the kind of terror that I feel when I watch two big skyscrapers come down. And I call that mediated terror. And it's a very, very strange thing, and I think we need to understand it more. The first time I felt that kind of mediated terror was when I was in a school child in New Jersey. This was before we went to Turkey. And we had to do the air raid drill because the Russians were coming. And in the event of a nuclear attack, we had to file out into the corridor and sit down and bury our heads in our knees, which wouldn't have done any good for us if we'd been actually attacked. But it was a very good way of bowing mutely to whatever the government said. I should add that around this time, same time, I was too young to understand this, but my father was working for a military physics lab, which was where the McCarthy witch hunts began. 98 of his colleagues were sacked, and all of them were reinstated, except for the two who committed suicide. But this was a story. I didn't hear about it for a while because I was a child. I heard it long before most Americans did, because there was that kind of terror that justified anything against somebody who was a purported communist, and anybody who was likely to be labeled that kept very, very quiet. Now, when I moved to Turkey, I saw this over and over and over again, the same kind of syndrome. You had a country that's democratically governed, militarily ruled, and whoever went up against the state got crushed. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, it was, you know, communists. More recently, it has been the intelligentsia, anybody who's working in the area of history who wants to challenge official history, the Kurds, Christian minorities, and Islamists. Now, notice I've said the Islamists last. There are many, many kinds of Muslims in Turkey, as in most countries. The largest minority is Alevi, who are egalitarian Muslims. They're also the most they're also the most persecuted. The AK party, which is an Islamist party in power, is actually pro-European and pro-market as well as being being Islamist. So you have a very wide variety, and you have. Sorry, I got upset.
Okay.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
If I can find out what I was going to say. You have a very complicated country, and the best people to explain that country to you and the way in which Islam plays in it are the intellectuals. Those intellectuals who should be here talking in my place are mostly under police guard at the moment. They're subjected to death threats. They have to choose their battles very carefully. It's been made clear to them that if they say the wrong thing, things might not go so well for them. That means that as far as writers are concerned, in the face of what's going on post 9/11, that those of us who live in freer places have to speak for them. So that's my final rule on what I'm here, why I'm here today, which is break the silence. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Maureen. Okay, so, well, lots of fascinating ideas thrown up. I mean, maybe we could start by going back to September 11th, 2001, and maybe that question which Martin mentioned, the question of why, which came up in so many people's minds. I mean, Ed, could you perhaps say something about your reaction to that day and possibly explanations which then and since began to become clear to you?
9/11 for me was a big wake-up call in several ways, and I've documented that in my book. And I think the difference in my response to 7/7 was one that, in hindsight, I'm more comfortable with as a human being than the one that I experienced on the evening of September 11th, 2001. I remember going to a friend's house in London, and it was supposed to be a gathering of fellow Muslims where we'd get together. And remember, I'd left what I call, or most people now call, extremism, Islamism, at least 4 years before 9/11, and I thought I had cleansed my mind, and I thought I was no longer under the influences of this Islamist mindset, not Islamic, again, I emphasize, Islamist mindset, confrontation with the West, hostility towards Israel, literalist understanding of text, and looking down at fellow Muslims as well. I thought I had done away with all of that. But there was something in me that evening that felt joyous, that this was right, that the Americans somehow deserved it. And I remember asking fellow Muslims that evening in this particular gathering, what are we doing to celebrate? And the response that night, despite having left Islamism, and the point I'm trying to make here is that operationally many people may have left, but the residue of that ideology still festers in many, many people's minds. The response from them was, what's there to celebrate? And these were, by and large, Muslims who are under Sufi influences, who believed in Islam as a religion and not as a political ideology, and so on. And you know, they took me right back to the source of Islam, and I remember them distinctly talking about the Prophet Muhammad and saying, do you really think that the Prophet Muhammad would be in any way proud of what happened today? And there was a presence with these people, and they weren't just talking about the Prophet in empty terms, but they were spiritual people who had a certain connection. I think people who don't have faith may find this difficult to comprehend, but there was a certain presence in that room, there was a certain presence in these people who gave me several historical anecdotes from the time of the Prophet and repeatedly made those comments about the Prophet condemning. I mean, I make the point, you know, Muslims aren't pacifists. We believe in a just war. There is such a thing as jihad. I'm not going to take it away, but there's a context and a time and place for it. Just like millions of Muslims from India fought in the Second World War against the Nazis because it was the right thing to do, Muslims in the past, by and large, fought against oppression and evil. And it was in that context that the Prophet took up the sword. And they took me back to that, and they repeatedly said to me, think about his admonitions, which are documented in what we call mutawatir ahadith, or you know, valid sayings of the Prophet, where he spoke out against killing women, killing children, killing innocent people who weren't armed, not poisoning wells, not uprooting trees, not killing animals. So there are 101 conditions attached to a Muslim taking up the sword. And like one Muslim scholar said, we take the sword up to take the sword out of madmen's hands. So that was my initial response to 9/11. Now, by then I like to think I was on a path to deliberately cleanse my mind, but to see that response within me then on the evening of 9/11, looking back, I ask myself, why? Why was it that someone who was born and raised in London, by all reckonings a close ally of the United States, feels somehow, even mildly at least, happy that mass carnage had visited America? I mean, that question still remains valid, that why is it there are still so many others who feel that way? But as I started off with the answer that by 7/7, by then I was living in Saudi Arabia when 7/7 happened, and my initial gut reaction then, and this was without thinking about 9/11, was then an initial sense of, oh my God, I so hope this isn't fellow Muslims. And I think, you know, it's probably not the sort of most appropriate thing to say, but in every dark clouds is a silver lining, and then the silver lining for 9/11 was that many, many Muslims across the world asked themselves, what is it that's going on? Why is it that Islamists have hijacked our faith, and why is it that we remain silent? And one of the reasons why after 7/7 I felt compelled to write the book that I did was because it was, you know, I felt a responsibility for people like me to speak out and amplify our testimonies.
My reaction to September the 11th, one thing that we must stress about this event was its suddenness. It is probably the greatest event in world history since 1989, the real 9/11, because it's 11th of November, when the Berlin Wall was decisively breached. But that, everyone had seen that coming. You know, that wall was crumbling at its foundations long before then. It had been crumbling in a way since 1917. As one historian put it, socialism does not exist and the Soviet Union built it. But no one saw September the 11th happening. I mean, no citizen did. No one saw it on its way, although there'd been a previous attack on the World Trade Center. So the massive suddenness, as well as the natural size of the event, and as Maureen says, its mediated nature, and it was intended to be mediated, and the pause between the two airplanes striking the World Trade Center to give the world time to look. And just to be personal for a moment, I felt, and I felt it for months afterwards, I felt decisively silenced. I mean, the reason so many novelists wrote about September the 11th was because they couldn't write about anything else. They couldn't think about anything else. And I was reminded of the Kafka short story, Josephine or the Mouse People. It's a brilliant story about an opera singing mouse. Josephine sings opera to mice, and thousands of mice come to listen to her sing. And she has a sort of crisis with her throat. And she does a first concert for quite a while, and thousands of mice are all ranged there to listen to her. And after she's been singing for a second, one mouse turns to another and says, "Sing? She can't even squeak." And that was what I felt like. And just the most vivid symptom of the kind of malaise that I felt was, for quite a while afterwards, I would go out into the street and I couldn't understand why cars stopped at the red light and waited and didn't move on until the light was green. It just seemed incomprehensible to me. And you'd see some self-righteous bicyclist, you know, sticking out his arm to indicate a right-hand turn. You think anyone's going to take any notice of that? And that was just a symptom of my conviction, or strong feeling, that that this was a kind of attack on reason.
Well, My cousin was the sole survivor of his office in the second tower. My stepson saw the second plane go into the building. He was at a building very, very close by. My brother-in-law was on his way into the Pentagon just before the crane plane. So my response to it was very, very personal, mm-hmm. and horrified. I am against U.S. Foreign policy in many of the areas that we're going to be discussing, but that didn't mean that I wasn't absolutely didn't take it very, very personally. Wasn't completely horrified. Now, one thing I noticed as time went on was this terrible thing happened to us. That was the way that people used to talk about it in the beginning. American friends, relatives, and so on. After a while, they started saying, this terrible thing happened to us. And then I started getting feeling very uncomfortable, as if an American life was supposed to be more important than lives elsewhere. I think my second thought when this happened was, why did this have to happen when Bush was in power? Because it was inevitable how he was going to use it. I always wonder what would have happened if somebody wiser had been there. That said, I think that for all the bad things that have happened, starting from the White House going outwards, there has been something else going on in the U.S. ever since 9/11, which is we haven't done our homework. A lot of people hate us. We better find out why, and in fact, we better stop. Just looking at our navels, we better start engaging with the world. And I think that there has been a very, very serious attempt in publishing, in universities, to do that. It's not perfect, but it's pretty strong, and it seems to be stronger now even than it was a few years ago.
Okay, thanks. Maybe to move on to a related question, I mean, something that Maureen, you've already brought up, that I mean, debates about terrorism are always or often the flip side of them are debates about the West or about America and American values. And Martin has already mentioned his sense of a kind of Western morality, which is we shouldn't be ashamed of. I wonder if we could maybe talk a little bit about that, because Ed, you in your book argue quite strongly for a sense of if not Western, then perhaps British values. But many people, I think, maybe people certainly on the left would suggest that those values have been sort of fatally undermined by British and U.S. foreign policy. So could you speak about that, your sense of British values and how they would factor into this debate?
I talk about British values because the audience for that book was primarily and remains primarily British, but it must be placed in a wider context of universal human values. These aren't Western values. Women's rights, the rights of minorities, it's to say that these were primarily Western, they came about as a result of the Enlightenment and there was nothing before that. Now, those values of fairness, justice, and so on existed in all of the three world faiths in varying degrees. I mean, whether you're talking about the Jewish people, Christian people, or Muslim people, I freely concede that in their times there were problems and they weren't the most perfect example, but the roots were there, whether it's from the teachings of Jesus, or the teachings of Muhammad, or the teachings of Moses or Abraham, the roots of human equality were there. Those teachings were later taken on and developed further. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights and so on. I mean, that's what I'm referring to, and I think there's a lot to be said for those. And I think the logical conclusion of those very raw teachings are where the West is today, and there's absolutely no harm in trying to share that with the rest of the world, but without it coming across as being excessively assertive or inherently arrogant. And that's where I think we tend to upset a lot of people in the Muslim East. And I speak as someone who I think, is part of a new generation of people who was born and raised here, and by and large understands the Muslim East, and also understands the secular West. And it's a challenge for my generation as to how to bridge those two gaps and bring about a civilizational harmony. But a way to do that is not to go around preaching in the Arab world, and it doesn't work. I know Abu Ghraib was, you know, you can say it was just a one-off and it doesn't reflect the West, and you can say Guantanamo Bay is an anomaly, but the reality in the Arab street is that that's what they see, and that's what Arabs understand to be, rightly or wrongly, the West. And we've got to go around doing this in a better way, and it can be done, but it requires the mindset and the willpower to say that we will continue to retain, as Martin puts it, moral superiority, but without putting it in those terms of that we are somehow therefore far more arrogant and inherently superior. I mean, it's a way of being a little bit more diplomatic, I think.
Yes, Sam Harris in The End of Faith ventured this. The idea that, it goes very much against the multiculturalist idea, and it is, as Ed says, inflammatory. But we have to be able to make these judgments. And he says, you know, look at New York of the 1890s, run by armed gangs, corrupt police, and with lynchings of blacks. America's evolved since then. There are various fairly obvious ways of judging this evolution. I would say that Britain is a more evolved, morally evolved society than America for a couple of very obvious reasons. No capital punishment. America's capital punishment is on a level with China and Iran, and that's a disgrace to any Western country. And gun law, for instance. So when you suggest that Britain is more morally evolved than the Taliban, it's not a racial slur. It's not that they're incapable of evolving, it's just that they haven't evolved. And I don't think one should be terrorized by relativism and feel unable to make that kind of judgment. And there would be many indexes of this sort of moral wealth, as Harris calls it. Separation of church and state would be one. Distance from violence in solving, you know, civil disputes, and it's something that requires constant revision. I mean, Abu Ghraib did, you know, untold harm to the West, but compare it with My Lai, 1968, a full-scale massacre of 500 people with all the worst things you've ever read about committed on that day. And what was the response in America? A rockabilly hit song called The Battle Hymn of William Kelly, which went straight to number one in the charts. Applause in Congress when Kelly's sentence was reduced from, I think, 12 years hard labor to 1 year of house arrest. And in the polls, 80% support for the military. That was a massacre. And you compare that 40 years on with the American response to Abu Ghraib, and you'll see what moral evolution is.
Well, I'd like to question again the way that we're using the terms East and West. I have to say this because I live in a place, and I grew up in a place in which people are drawing from both traditions, which is a very, very difficult thing to do, to draw from both traditions, but they're not living in two different places, they're living in one place. And they are also going to the same schools. Now, if we just put aside these terms, East and West, and just looked at the education systems of the world, the university in which I grew up in Turkey has been in place since 1863. There's been education, Eastern, Western, whatever you want to call it, is combined, going on all that time. That has huge effects. It's one of the reasons why Turkey has the highest percentage of tenured women professors in the world. Now, if you looked at this university or all the other British universities, you see very, very international population. This is a slow change, but incredibly important type of change. And to talk about East and West is completely to miss the point of what's going on here. The types of conversations that are going on amongst all people from many different so-called Eastern and Western backgrounds, what they take from it. It's a lifetime to solve a lot of the dilemmas that rise, the contradictions that rise out of that. But that's the important conversation. This ideological conversation about we in the West, they in the East, doesn't help towards knowledge or understanding at all. In my view, it just justifies invasions.
Okay, I think we're about time that we can start opening up to the audience for questions. There are, I think, a couple of microphones coming around. So if you have a question, could you wait for the microphone to reach you, and then could you try and state the question as concisely as possible, because we have got a large audience, so I'd appreciate it if you could keep your questions quite brief. So, but if anyone has got a question, please raise your comment. Please raise your hand. There's a gentleman right there. Oh, there's the.
So far, it seems to me the whole discussion has hinged around 9/11 and its impact. But for me, the kind of grudge it seems that Arab peoples in particular have is all about Palestine and the terrible injustices that go on there. And despite all this increasing moral authority the West is supposed to have, we're not doing anything about it. And isn't that what's wrong? Isn't that why 9/11 happened?
May I answer? I think it has a lot to do with it, yes. I think that the US foreign policy is always distorted by the refusal to confront what's going on. And it will continue to be distorted until we, Americans, do address this properly. So I agree with you. But I guess I'm the only one.
I'm afraid I don't agree with the basic premise of that question. 9/11 was being planned for several years before President Bush came to power. I've got no truck with President Bush whatsoever, but that's just a historical fact. It took several years of planning. I put the question back to you. I lived in the Arab world for 3 years. I lived in Syria. I traveled widely across the Arab world. I lived also in Saudi Arabia. And the thing that struck me repeatedly, and I mean, I'm not spinning this in any way whatsoever. I mean, it's a sincere question. What's the Arab world doing about Palestine? And again, if I may complete my sentence, Palestinians living constantly on the fringes of Damascus, over a million Palestinians living in horrid, horrid camps in Lebanon. They have no dignity and status in Saudi Arabia. They're treated in horrendous terms across the Arab world, and repeatedly you have Arab leaders making this hoo-ha about the Arab-Israeli conflict. Well, why not do something about it and sort it out among yourselves rather than constantly blaming the West? It's not a blame game. This is where we are. Let's fix it. There's no point being children in primary school and saying who did it.
Martin, do you have a response to that?
Bringing on Israel to fix it. I'm sure the Palestinians would compromise given any kind of fair deal at all, but they don't seem to be.
Well, they threw out what was nearly a fair deal.
No, it wasn't.
Well, anyway, I think this is a distorted sympathy. In the West, in Britain at least, sympathy for Palestine has always been of the left, a very strong tradition. I have a lot of sympathy for Israel. It is not nothing to have had 6 million of your number murdered in Central Europe in this last century. Do you think that has no psychological effect on a nation or on a religion or on a race, whatever you want to call the Jews? Do you think, the Palestinians have never suffered anything as remotely terrible as that, and yet the sympathy of Britain is all with Palestine and not with Israel, and there's an inexplicable numbness about Israel and no empathy whatever for this race that's been persecuted throughout its entire history.
So for this sympathy, give them somebody else's country.
OK, Okay, can we, thank you, sir. We have to have another question, though.
Those wrongs of history can't be disputed. Those are historical facts. That's what happened. The issue is, where do you go from here? And where do you go from here is what fellow Arabs can do to help. I mean, why is it that the EU pays more for the Palestinians than all the Arabs put together? But if I may just finish what I'm saying, is that this argument that somehow if the Palestinian problem is solved, all will be well, I'm sorry, I can't buy that. In my time inside extremist organizations, it was clearly understood that Palestine was just an excuse to be used, not just for leverage for the what we call the movement, but for the cause in the wider sense. That let's imagine for a moment that somehow the Arab-Israeli conflict, and let's pray to God that it does come to an end, that there is an amicable solution, that the Palestinians do indeed stop harboring this aim of annihilating Israel, that the Hamas reviews its charter and says that we will indeed recognize Israel and therefore we want to come to an agreement. I mean, right across the Arab world, my Arab friends can testify to this, that there is this inherent distrust of even wanting to sit down and get, bring some sort of peace in the Middle East with Israel. There is a feeling that there is no need to want to recognize Israel. School children are taught that Israel doesn't exist. Leaving aside all that, and let's assume that somehow there was a two-state solution and all was well. Are you seriously suggesting that the Islamist agenda, as articulated by several Islamist groups, and I can name them for you if you want, that overthrowing of every single Arab ruler, the creating of a single state with an expansionist foreign policy, and the subjugating of other Muslims who don't agree with them, will somehow then just wither away and Islamism and its mindset of attacking and harboring hatred for the West will no longer exist? Of course it will. It's a mindset which festers hatred, and that will go on whether Palestine is there or not. Okay.
I understand what you're saying about the responses of Arab countries to the Palestine situation, but never forget that it is the U.S. that bankrolls Israel, and that's why the U.S. Has to come to grips with this if there's going to be a solution. And also, whatever is going on in the Middle East, the fact remains that U.S. Middle East foreign policy is very much influenced by the Israel First agenda. And I'm hopeful that is going to shift, and I will do everything I can to write about it as and when it happens. I don't see any solution happening until we have that shift in the U.S. Straighten out its foreign policy. I'm not asking people to be pro or against either, but if you're going to talk about a solution, you've got to look at where the money's coming from. No, I think I have to remind you that I didn't say that the U.S. should pull the money out. That would be absolutely ridiculous. But the fact is that it's the big player in this question. No, don't ask me what I imply. Ask me what I say, and I'll tell you. I said it should address it, because it's a powerful player. It's the money person. It's the money thing. Yeah.
Of course, if you say it should address it,
No. Yeah.
If they weren't there, Israel would collapse.
Yeah, but however, the U.S. could influence a change in policy in Israel that might actually make a future for Israel. Things are not looking very good right now. We want something better.
Bribery.
Now. Bribery?
Yes, we will withdraw our support.
No.
Okay, we have, thanks, sir, but we have quite a few other people asking questions. Beth, there's someone just behind you there.
If I can return slightly to literature themes. in a way, there's something which literature and terrorism obliquely share, in that literature, particularly as Professor Amos introduces it, is something which one wishes to be morally efficacious in the world, which does more than simply sits there on the page. But is there a danger in an era of mass media broadcast terrorism that as writers one looks at what terrorism does, and literature shrivels up in the face of that and becomes something one can no longer have faith in as a moral force in the world.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question bit of that one.
I think the question was, can, in the face of terrorism, can literature, does it have anything to say, I suppose?
Well,
is that what you said?
Sorry, I meant in terms of writers' feelings, does terrorism feel like a threat to literature as a moral force in the world?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't feel that way to me. We must all bow to the Italian-American novelist Don DeLillo, who wrote in 1991 that in the future, the mood will not be set by novelists and poets. It will be set by terrorists. And I find that this is very much the case. But what literature does is respond to reality. It is about the individual making sense of the world. And that part of the job is completely unchanged.
Well, I think I spoke to this subject a little bit, and I really do think that it's important in the face of terrorism to look at the stories beneath the radar, beyond the frame, also to look at the way in which stories are framed so you don't believe them anymore when you see them on television. You see the camera crews also taking their pictures and then leaving, questioning when stories begin and when they end. Have you noticed that every time a lot of these terrorist attacks look the same? Because it begins with an explosion. It ends up when the last interesting person gets out of hospital. So I think there's an awful lot to do. It's a challenge, but you have to get through that terror onto the other side to look at what's actually going on and to record it, the little human things, the way we live, and how we can carry on living even if we are terrorized.
Okay, other questions? Oh, there's someone at the front here.
I'm interested in how, if you are both a journalist and a novelist, how you approach the task in hand. Is there a different, do you sort of differentiate between what you're doing with a journalist's head and what you're doing with a novelist's head, and what's the different tasks appropriate to those two roles?
I've had many experiences of the difference in that I've looked into things as a journalist or as an amateur historian might do, and then a couple of years later I felt the need to write fiction about it. And the difference is that what's happened to that information is, and it doesn't always happen, but it goes from the front of the brain to the back of the brain and down the spine into the cortex and enters your unconscious mind. And that is the difference. I always think of writing journalism and criticism as writing left-handed. Where the connection isn't to the part of me that novels come from. But the difference on this subject on September the 11th is that I could write some journalism within a week, but as Norman Mailer said, the temptation to charge in with fiction is very great, but you must let it make that process. It must weave and trickle through you, and then perhaps you'll have something to say in fiction.
Well, I would go farther and say that it's not wearing different hats, it's actually using different parts of the brain. And when you're doing journalism, it's very negotiated, very mediated. You have an editor who's gotten been to a meeting and they've decided to do a story, and you get instructions and you get sent out, and you're very aware that if you want to get to the audience that you desire, you have to get past all those filters again. So you do the best that you can under the circumstances. And as Martin said, I'll quote you on fiction. Fiction is not what is or what was, but what might have been, what could have been, what should have been. And so it's a much more hypothetical, imaginative place where you can, you know, the only place in the world where you can go back and have a second try and a third try. Now, when I'm doing journalism, using that part of my brain, I can write on the kitchen sink, I can write upside down, I can finish it in 2 hours, no matter how long it is, and I can take phone calls throughout this time. If somebody interrupts me when I'm writing fiction, I have a terrible tantrum, because it's a different place where you go to find out, usually if it's going well, the thing that you find out is the last thing that you wanted to know. So it's more truthful.
Salman Rushdie made a good distinction, I think, just after the fatwa was pronounced on him. And he said, I'm writing a children's book. And I said, why are you doing that? You know, I wouldn't think of doing that, I don't think, unless I'd had a serious head injury in the recent past. And he said, well, I sort of have really. He said, you know, when I write a novel, what I have to do, and this is why you have tantrums when you're interrupted, is that you have to get yourself to the place within yourself where the novel is coming from, which means getting rid of all the world of distraction that we're all surrounded with. But the distraction was so powerful in his case that he said, by the time I reached the point where I found this part of myself, I'd be wrecked, he said. That effort alone exhausted him.
Any other questions? JT? Someone there. The gentleman behind you.
Each of the three speakers right now is attached to British universities as a PhD student, lecturers, research fellows. To what extent do you think Enlightenment values are advanced and protected, defended in the British university world these days?
If I could go first on this, I mean, I think British universities do embody Enlightenment values, but I also worry that the embodiment of those values can also be self-destructive if they're not selfishly guarded. And here I talk more about the unfettered, unlimited, perceived liberalism that's doing the rounds. Liberalism, you know, it came about over the last 300 years, and as I keep quoting Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi, wherever I go, because I'm reading his recent book, The Home We Build Together. He puts it very powerfully, I think, when he says it took 2 world wars to defend and 300 years of history to achieve. And that's not something that should be looked upon lightly or thrown away without much thought. But when you have, you know, granted, in relatively small numbers, student bodies who are determined to use this liberalism as a Trojan horse to then bring about a certain mindset that leads to violence, terrorism, then those institutions that are responsible for not just treasuring but valuing Enlightenment values have a responsibility to ask what's going on and what can we do to prevent this from happening. Right now, my hunch is that's not being done strongly enough.
Do you want to say something?
No. Okay.
Well, I think wonderful things are going on in British universities. I would go so far as to say there's a lot of heroic activity in British universities for 2 reasons, and one is the internal market. Oh. If any of you have to deal with it directly. I find that having to deal with learning outcomes and the various machinery to justify what I do, particularly in creative writing, makes a nonsense of what I'm trying to do. And in fact, if we do it at all effectively, oh God, this is being taped, isn't it? we have to hide it. We have to hide the good work we do in order to keep on teaching. The other thing that concerns me is that we're we're all government employees. We're all hired by the same people, and that does actually have an effect on freedom of expression inside universities. Although, as I said, heroic efforts to keep the Enlightenment traditions going, but it's and technically, I am not allowed to speak to myself because I'm a journalist as well, and really, I should seek the permission of my boss to speak to myself. But as you noticed, I haven't.
There was a question at the front.
I'd just like to challenge Ed Hussein's kind of assertion that responses to 9/11 appear to be the appropriate Western horror or a Islamist or Muslim response that's related to some kind of ideology that's in there that we haven't ourselves purged. I was in Thailand a couple of months after 9/11, which is not exactly a Muslim country, and in Bangkok, which doesn't have a majority Muslim population, there were lots and lots of signs that Bin Laden was seen as a folk hero, particularly amongst the poor. There were bus drivers who had pictures of him, you could buy posters of him, you could buy masks. And I think saying that 9/11 is a purely Muslims versus the West thing is playing exactly into the hands of Al-Qaeda or whoever it is you want to blame for these things. And in much of the developing world, it's the reason he was seen as a folk hero is because he was perceived to be challenging the US. I don't think this is a Muslim thing, and I think it's very sloppy to say that this is purely a Muslims versus the West issue.
I don't recall saying that it was just the pure...
It was your inference that your response to 9/11 had some joy in it, in a sense, because you hadn't purged yourself of this Islamist ideology. Gained all your British values.
Sure. No, I understand what you're saying, but my response was rooted in my sense of false understanding of religion. It's a very personal thing. I grant you that there were many people in Spain and other countries who took joy as well, and that was Cuba. I mean, that's not a Muslim issue. I fully accept that. But that was driven by anti-Americanism, and that's a widespread problem right across the world. But I'm sorry to say, the vanguard of anti-American sentiment, those who take it beyond just a mindset and widespread street protests, and who take up arms and become, you know, in the words of Martin, very disgusting, i.e. suicide bombers, are so far, by and large, I'm sorry to say, people who adhere to an Islamist worldview. And that's just a fact. It can't be disputed. There have been very few Spaniards or Cubans or others who've walked that path. Tamil Tigers, it's an internal dispute. It's not anti-American. Again, that's another fact. But this whole issue of suicide bombing, and I just want to make a public statement here, if I may, that, I mean, and it's not just Martin, the Muslim scholars such as Abdul Hakim Murad or T.J. Winter in Cambridge, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen from America and others have vociferously condemned suicide bombing along the very lines that Martin's enunciated tonight, i.e. disgusting, inhumane, barbaric, and so on. Yet, those journalists in the room here make note that there's a satellite channel number 813 that goes out on a 24-hour basis, set up by a closet jihadist in London. Two weekends ago, they had a gathering where there were 40,000 young Muslims who had gathered in the London Excel Center, which refuses to call suicide bombing a suicide bombing and glorifies it as human bombing. That's going on in our midst today, young Muslim children exposed to a 24-hour channel that pumped into our homes through the digital ghetto that refuses to name the beast for what it is, but rather gives it a nuanced, caveated, subhuman approach and justifies it as political protest. For as long as that goes on, you know, for as long as we turn our minds away from that and ignore it, you know, don't come asking 5, 6, 7 years later, when there are other suicide bombings going off, why did that happen? Because there's a mindset that's out there thinking that it's not suicide bombing and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just a human being giving up his or her life for a certain political cause.
We only have time for one quick question. Perhaps Beth, the gentleman. You keep it brief if you...
My question's for Martin Amis, and specifically relating to statements he made. Quite brave but disagreeable statements about the West response to 9/11 vis-a-vis the Muslim community, and how he's interrogated those ideas himself and how that might have affected his fiction and his writing.
Are you talking about the
Talking about the thought experiment regarding...
Well, I responded to that on Saturday, and I began by saying that as a courtesy to my Islamic readers, I would like to say in italic capitals that I do not advocate any discriminatory treatment of Muslims, and I never have. And no one with the slightest respect for truth can claim otherwise. You know, my remarks were prefaced by the remark, there is a definite urge to say. And I did have that urge, and I'll tell you why. It was August 2006, the revelation of the third jihadist, plans for the third jihadist massacre in Great Britain in 13 months. The plan was to blow up 10 transatlantic flights in transit with bombs made on board. Now, that's 3,000 people, and it's summer flights across the Atlantic, so very largely women and children. And you know, you can pretend to be a pious post-historical automaton and not have the responses, or you could admit to having transient retaliatory urges. You know, what do you want writers to do? Do you want them to pretend they didn't have these urges?
But why, Martin, refer to the Muslim community in this and not isolate them for what you've just done as jihadists? You know, even in that urge, why not say the jihadists have to get their house in order first, but well, the Muslim community needs
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I intuit that 95% of Muslims would very much like to get their house in order. And it's the Islamists or the jihadists who have, of course, the monopoly of intimidation and self-righteousness. Muslims yearn to get their house in order.
But, Martin, if you start a thought experiment, and I'm glad you did because it brings all this out into the open, but you have the obligation to finish it, and I really would like to take this opportunity to just say, do a bit more homework. Don't just look at the extremists. Look at everything. I mean, don't just read these stupid neocon books. Do more. Please, come to visit me in Turkey. You'll be very welcome. I just want you to know more, and not guess.
Okay. I'm sorry, we have to finish it there. Panel members will be, if you could stay in your seats just a few minutes, the panel members will be signing books at the table just at the bottom of the staircase. So if you let us get out before you start getting out, that'd be very helpful. But if you could just put your hands together and thank our three panelists as well.
Thank you.